Gentlemen, welcome back to the Go To Food Podcast. We're delighted to be joined by Tom Zahir, one of the greatest chefs in London and the founder of Decatur, which is a company which has basically looked at the food scene about 10 years ago in England and said, American food in this country is fucking awful. I want to make it epic. And you've done just that. Welcome to the pod.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Happy with that intro?
Yeah, that works.
Do you want to add anything?
Blowing some smoke up my arse already.
That's what we like to do.
I love that. Yeah,
we like to soften you down at first and then we sort of, you know, just beat you up a bit. But is it right that without punk rock, we wouldn't be here?
It is right. Well, to an extent. Yeah, I would say I went on my first European tour when I was 16. During a half term from school, and then went from there. But basically,
what does that do you mean, just following a band around,
or playing in a band and touring Europe?
Who was the band?
The band at the time that I was in was not, we were not very good, but we were called SVF. I did several as playing in them, and then several like touring with friends' bands, just kind of doing merch and just getting drunk in Europe. But yeah, that was the first one. I distinctly remember coming back from tour to come home and play a Battle of the Bands competition and play Cherub Rock by the Smashing Pumpkins. Really? In a Battle of the Bands, having to come back for a Sunday afternoon practice in like the music room at school, having played a show in Hull where we'd like got kicked out because our singer had smashed up the drum kit. It was crazy. But yeah, it's
very rock and roll.
But that's not how I started Decatur.
No,
necessarily.
This is a different podcast.
I don't want my mum to listen to that one. But so Decatur started. I lived, my first introduction to the food that we cook, which is from the south of the US and New Orleans and Louisiana, was because my friend's band from Nottingham was touring with a band from Louisiana, from Baton Rouge, the state capital, called Thou, who are still going, been like a mainstay in the heavy music scene in Louisiana for years. And they toured in the UK, and then they got invited to go and tour in the US with them, like a month, 5 week long tour. So I tagged along on that. Nice. I was basically like road dog for them.
Yeah.
Sang a couple of covers, some crossed out covers and stuff at shows, and then became, you know, quick friends with the guys at in the band. And that was, God, I think it was like 2008 or 9. And those guys obviously all lived in New Orleans and Baton Rouge. Yeah, I wound up having those relationships there. I actually immediately after that tour moved to London for about a year, and then got a job in New York, moved to New York, and worked in travel in a previous career, and would spend a lot of time just going down to see them. I would go to like punk shows and festivals in the South and like Texas, and go and visit those guys always.
Was food something you were interested in?
100%. I was always interested in food. My mum was a huge influence on me in terms of the food that we ate growing up, and we always ate really well.
What did you eat? Just give us an idea of some of your favourite dishes from your mum's.
God, so I'm mixed race. So my mum's Pakistani, my dad's a Geordie. We grew up with loads of stuff. So like the comfort food for me is Pakistani food. So if we go home, it'll be having Sikh kebabs and grilled lamb chops, or having kichra, or eating dal. And you know, my mum makes incredible Pakistani food, influenced by her mum. So we ate a lot of that, but she's also lived in France for a bit, and she did various different things. So we would eat all kinds of stuff. So some nights we'd be eating French food, we'd be having coq au vin or whatever, and then we'd be having loads of Middle Eastern food, loads of like Iranian food, Lebanese food, and yeah, a lot of Pakistani food. But yeah, I was interested in food. I just, you know, like when you move, I didn't realize how cushy I had it until I left, and I was like, oh God, like I've got to do this to myself. When I moved to the States, that was at the same time that I was going to Louisiana a lot, I was also sort of figuring out like what I really wanted, because I was on a short-term visa at the time. And so I knew that I was going back to the UK, and I was like, I don't want to go back to the same place that I've and do the same job long-term. So I started like staging in some restaurants in New York. One in particular, Teresi, which has just reopened, which was the first place that I ever worked in a kitchen.
Was that baptism of fire? How did that play out?
I was so... not ready to do that. I was not ready for that. I mean, it's a one Michelin star kitchen, and the room is the kitchen was not much bigger than this space, and there's probably like 7 chefs, 2 KPs in this space, like raging fire behind me. They had me doing really like the most commie jobs, like picking through crab for shell, and like I had to mince liver for something, frozen liver, and making breadcrumbs, chopping garlic, stuff like that. And it's a humbling experience, man. Like when you think you're like, you can throw down in the kitchen at home, and then you go and someone's like, you're not even holding that knife right, you're not even doing this right, you're like, oh God, it's just a different way
really
of working.
It was stripping you back right to kind of...
Yeah, it was actually like, I found it really intense, and I think like it definitely made me like question, like, is this the life that I want? Because I would have gone in as a commie, I think. think, into any kitchen. Or certainly if I wanted to cook that kind of like Michelin star fancy food. But it made me think about like what I wanted.
Was it good star food though in the Michelin star restaurant?
Honestly, like I remember getting there. I got there at 7. I had a bagel from that. I lived in Brooklyn and there's a bagel shop right next to the train where I took into the city. And I got a bagel in the morning. So I should get something down me, a bagel, like a shitty cup of coffee, and then got there at 7:30, and I worked through. They had me work until they started service, and then they were like, you can watch service if you want, you can't do anything, but you have to stand on the fire escape. You know, like in New York, they have the like the chutes down for deliveries. They wouldn't let me sit. They were like, you have to stand if you want to watch what we're doing, how service is going. So I watched Mario Carbone of Carbone run the service. He was actually real nice. Rich Teresi's was hard. I don't know what they're like now, but he was quite a, he was the one that made me stand for the first night. And then from then, they would let me go up into the, they had like a little prep kitchen upstairs in the old Teresi that was literally like enough for a couple of chopping boards. And they let me kind of go and stand with the chef that was running, I guess it'd be like garde manger, like cold apps from there. So yeah, it was intense. But staff food, I remember them saying their staff food and then me looking at all this stuff that they'd given me to do and being like, I don't think I have time to eat this. And then, yeah, getting home at like 11 or whatever, once I've been allowed to go, eating a couple slices of pizza and being like, God.
Where were your favourite places to eat in New York if you did have a day off?
If I had a day off, it's actually, that city changes so much that I'm sure a lot of the places that I used to really like have gone. I used to love a little French restaurant in Greenpoint called Le Gamin, and they do like, you could have unlimited mussels and wine on a on a Monday night. That place used to be great. I used to love going and eating pizza in different places, so like L&B and Totono's and New Park Pizza out in near the airport. Like I have a couple of, two of my best friends over there are real like Brooklyn Italian Americans. So they would take me to all the different joints. So I'd go out with those guys. But those kind of spots. I think New York was really the place that the first time I ever had money to spend on eating. So like when I moved to London, I had no money other than like going and getting a kebab at, on Green Lanes or something. Like when I moved to New York, actually it was weird because I shouldn't have had money because New York's incredibly expensive, but I had some weird tax loop in the visa that I was on. I didn't have to pay a bunch of the taxes and I got commission. So I had a little bit of expendable cash and I was like, you know. And actually the big thing for me was New York versus London was that when I socialized with my friends, I did it over food and not over beer. And so the first port of call was always, where shall we eat? And the second was like, what bar should we go to? Whereas with my friends, it was here and still is to some extent. It's like, where are we going to have a drink? And is there somewhere to get food later? Like there's scampi fries. Let's not worry about it. You know. So.
Tell us about Decatur though, because obviously you're obsessed with the food of the Deep South, New Orleans, Louisiana. What food are you doing? What can they expect?
What I've always tried to do with it is cook food that's recognizable to somebody that loves New Orleans or is from New Orleans and do it with British produce in a different environment. So the food that we serve, typically, I guess you could call it a greatest hits of Louisiana. There's a very distinct striation between Creole and Cajun cookery, but we kind of have a little bit of both. I would say probably in Louisiana, the best Cajun chefs and the best Creole chefs are two kind of fairly distinct different parts. But we do a little bit of the greatest hits of Louisiana and some of the further things of the South, just because we're not as constrained, I suppose. In terms of what that means, we do a lot of, we cook a lot of seafood. So one of the dishes that kind of when I first started, which was 2014, that everyone knew us for was char grilled oysters. So we'd use like
award winning timeout 2016.
You take, look at the knowledge.
Take us through the recipe.
Exactly.
What do you do with them?
So the recipe, so we make like a garlic and pecorino compound butter. So butter with garlic, pecorino whipped into it, and then shuck fresh rock oysters from Maldon in Essex. Put a sizable scoop of that on top of the oysters, throw them on a barbecue, and you just let them grill. And then what happens is that the butter kind of drips down onto the coals, and then that in turn makes flames lick up over the oysters. And so you have this like beautiful situation where you're getting this butter slowly melting, the oysters poaching from underneath as it kind of the shell gets hot, and then the flames are licking the top and kind of almost crisping up some of the edges. We finish it with a little bit of spice, like a Cajun seasoning that we do without salt in, because the oysters are really salty. And then to finish it, some fresh parsley and some crystal hot sauce, like a pepper sauce, squeeze a lemon, and then we serve them by the half dozen, by the dozen.
Keep going. What else can we get? No, honestly, keep going. What else can we get from you? You're on a roll.
So the other thing,
and I'm getting turned on in a weird way.
The other thing that we're really well known for is seafood boils. So like real kind of New Orleans or Cajun style seafood boils, whereby they are cooked in an incredibly spicy and kind of aromatic stock or spice blend with lots of like onions and garlic and citrus, and then allowed to poach. And so that could be shrimp or crab or crayfish or whatever we can get our hands on, and then served to the table. You know, they're kind of poured over the table with corn on the cob and smoked andouille sausage and little baby potatoes, that kind of thing. So we started, I've always boiled seafood as part of what we've done because it's such an integral part of the cuisine and culture of the South, or the Queen's cuisine and culture of Louisiana especially. But in lockdown, that was one of the things that sort of saved my ass. Yeah, it went crazy, yeah. We started selling it as like a little meal kit in lockdown two, at the start of lockdown two, and then people just went mad for...
So you were like the Peloton of lockdown, weren't you, for food-wise?
Yeah,
like
we were putting the pounds on and Peloton was taking the pounds
yeah,
off.
Yeah, it was incredible, the growth there. You must have been like... I mean, how did you manage that? Because suddenly you just blew up beyond compare overnight.
Yeah, it was weird, actually. I mean, like an abridged history of that period from when we started to lockdown. Basically, I started as a street food thing because that was like a really easy entryway into the market at that time. Sort of different now because you've got pop-ups and takeovers and residencies and things where you can go in and cook behind the pans. But at the time, it was like street. If you want to start a small food business, street food is a good way to go. It's blowing up in like 2014-15. So I'd started and I'd worked with Curb and then... Basically, within 6 months, I'd bought a van, and my dad's a woodworker. He like makes cabinets and stuff, and he built me this kind of. It looks like an old Creole. It looked like almost like an old Creole cottage frontage for a gazebo. So cool. Had it all sorted. Had a little transit van that I'd got. Ex auto glass transit van, and then like one morning I woke up and someone had nicked the whole thing from my front.
Your van got, that was all over Instagram.
Yeah, it was mad. I just parked up one night. Weirdly, the day before I'd gone home, I lived in bottom of Clissold Park in a rented flat, and a really nice road, like super beautiful, like tree line. Yeah. And I parked up one night, I'd finished a market, and I had my sort of stuff in the van, and I was like, oh, I'll unload that later. And as I parked up, there's a bloke, there's two exactly the same kind of short wheelbase transit vans parked on our road.
Yeah.
Mine and this other guy. And this other guy came up to me and was like, have you seen my van? And I was like, no. I thought he was being like, you're in my van. And I was like, that's definitely mine.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's gone. It's been nicked. And I was like, you're fucking joking, man. I'm so sorry. Like, what's happened? That's crazy. And then the next morning, I get up. I think I had another market or something on later that day. So my partner goes off to work, and then I went downstairs, like get dressed, have a shower, whatever, have my breakfast, go downstairs to get in the van to go and start work or whatever. And I'm like, oh, it's gone. And I was like, I parked it there, right? Yeah. And then I'm walking up and down the road, and I'm like, oh, it's been nicked. Oh, someone's nicked it. And it had been hard. Like street food was not the one for Decatur. Yeah. Like it's a... we can go into the politics of how markets work, but when you're
I also read that you were getting abused at one of the markets post Pamela.
That was another one. Yes, it involved somebody throwing tins of Old Bay seasoning at me. That was amazing. That was a good story, actually. Yeah. Yeah. So we basically, when the van was gone, I was like, I've got to rethink what I do, and so I kind of felt like I was in for a penny, in for a pound. I was like, this thing's got some legs. Like, there's some stuff that we've done that's been really good.
Yeah.
Street food markets where I'm like competing against burgers and pizzas and fried chicken was always a bit of a crapshoot, to be honest. But what worked really well was when we had markets where it's a little bit more food focused and people were maybe more interested in trying things than just going in for their lunch. That was not the place for me. And so I got chatting to a mate of mine, Dino, who was opening a bar called Pamela at the time in Dalston, which is now a bit of a mainstay down that drag. And they had a license which required food in their bar for them to be open. So they built a little kitchen upstairs, and I sort of had a chat to him, and they were like, well, we'll give it a go. And then that was probably 18 months in Pamela from the end of 2015 to the very start of 2017 that we were in Pamela. And that was really good. That was really kind of like where a lot of the development of the business came, and the recipes and the sort of some of the core people that still come to events today
first, found you there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, I think, you know, props to Dino and the Pamela guys, because I was like pretty green. Like, if I look back at what I was doing now, like, I would do it differently. But at the time, you know, I was figuring stuff out, and I managed to have some good people come in and work with me who taught me a few things, and I taught them a few things, and we grew. And then, yeah, that brings me to the following summer. There'd been some, like, speculation around trying to open a restaurant post-Pamela. We'd won 2016's Best Dish of the Year in Time Out. So we had a bit of, like, inertia, you know, had a bit of inertia. And so a few people had been, like, come and open a restaurant with us. And so I was like, yeah, it's going to happen. But I still needed to kind of keep the wheels turning. And so I got offered an opportunity to go and cook at a street food kind of like bar come, I don't know, food place in Paddington.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm...
Was it Pergola?
It was Pergola, yeah.
Yes, it was Pergola.
Pergola on the rooftop.
I want to be diplomatic, but I don't really
Essex.
Care.
Essex.
Fuck them. They told me that it was going to be one thing, and it completely wasn't.
Yeah.
They sold me the vision of it being all these incredible restaurants from the East London and like London dining scene at the time that were coming in, and they were going to do it, and it's going to be really food forward. And so I pitched them this menu that was like really elaborate, and we're going to have cast iron in the wood burning oven and be cooking crackling cornbread and stuff. And then we got there and we were next to like a juice bar and Patty and Bun.
Yeah.
And it was like, well,
I worked at a kebab bar there.
Yeah, maybe that was the one.
Bebe Brothers.
Yeah, it could have been next door.
Yeah.
And then they told me this thing, and then we got there, and it was like, is this, the whole place was made of like OSB, chipboard, and
Essex Girls.
And Essex Girls. Yeah. And it was like just terribly run.
Really?
Terribly run. At one point, the roof blew off. In high winds.
It was the fire fest of kind of food places, wasn't it?
It's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And I just would, you know, the issue that I had was that I was on my own, it was my only site.
Yeah.
But a lot of the other, in fact, I think all the other places that were on the little run of five traders, they all had three or four sites.
Mm.
So we were basically reliant on this trade, whilst all those other ones, it was just like a small revenue stream for them. Yeah. And so when things went wrong, the other businesses were like, oh, whatever, and weren't kicking up a fuss, but I would kick up a fuss and they'd just tell me to shut up, basically.
Really?
And so there was a few things that went wrong, the roof blowing off being one of them and them having to close. One weekend before a bank holiday, we had a whole fridge full of like fresh crayfish, oysters, shrimp, all this like really nice seafood because we were expecting a big weekend. I was also doing the Beaver Town Beer Festival offsite. And they just, like, the whole power to the entire site went. Like, somebody had drilled or cut through, like, a mains, and UK Power Networks had to come out. So we just lost, like, $4,000, $5,000 of stock. And they were like, sorry, mate. And we're like, I can't absorb... Like, I've just made $5,000 being here for, 2 months. And now I've just spent it all. So there's all these, like, stressful moments culminating in one evening where a gentleman... he was like, I thought he was real nice, but it turned out he was a bit wired. And he came up and he was like, you've got Old Bay fries. I'm from the US. I love Old Bay. And I was like, great. And this was pre being able to buy Old Bay. Like, this is when if you bought Old Bay, you were buying a tin of Old Bay on Amazon for like 15 quid. So we did like our own Old Bay, and it said Old BAE on there.
Right, okay.
And so we were like, you know, it wasn't Old Bay, but it was the flavors of Old Bay on these like waffle fries.
Yeah.
And he was like, you're doing Old Bay? And I was like, oh, yeah, we are. But I'll let you into a secret. It's actually our own blend. Like, it's really expensive to get it here. And he was like, you duplicitous bastard. You're trying to sell your product on the good name of the McCormick Spice Company or something along those lines. Good. And he just wouldn't leave it. And he was offering money to my staff to leave.
What?
He was like waving £50 notes in my staff's face saying like, I'll give you £50 to walk out on this bastard right now. And we were telling security, this guy's like verbally abusing me. Jesus. And they were just like, oh, we can't really do much. And it was like, well, why are you here? What? And anyway, so this went on and on, and it ended up with him being vaguely racist to one of my staff members, him trying to swing for him across the side, me grabbing him by the chef pants and pulling him back into the kitchen and being like, chill, bro, like, it's fine. Let's just take a second. I was like, it's, you know, he's mad at me, not at you. Let's not make it a big deal. But being quite a harrowing evening, the next day, my friend Jenny, who now is a fabulous pastry chef, but she was working with me because she just got back from living abroad. And she was kind of like looking, she was like my second in command there. She was like, what happened last night? Like, the kitchen's a bit of a mess. Like, you didn't do a great close down. And I was like, look, I'm really sorry. We had a really stressful evening. This guy was like giving a shit and we all just wanted to get out of there. So he probably, yeah, I'm sorry. So the next, so we have a chat and I was like trying to tell her what's happened. And she's like, okay, whatever. 2 days later, I'm off. It's my night off. And I get a text from Jen. It's like, the Old Bay guy's here. He's come back.
He wasn't finished.
And he's brought a box of Old Bay seasoning with him. Like an industrial box of Old Bay seasoning.
What is wrong with this man?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think he was a little bit mentally challenged, unstable or whatever. Yeah. I was like, okay, well, just tell him we don't want it and try and ask him to leave. And then I don't hear anything. And then at 11 o'clock, she's like, you won't believe what's happened. And essentially what had happened, he'd offered it to them. They'd said no. He'd kicked up a fuss about it. They tried to calm him down and he just kept escalating and escalating and escalating to the point where he was screaming and shouting in the restaurant area on the benches and then started lobbing these tins of Old Bay, which are like 300-400 gram little bricks basically covered in metal at us or at our kitchen.
Oh my God.
And missing and like hitting the other people that were like trading. One of them fell in a fryer of the guys next to us while someone was frying, so they got splashes of oil.
What?
And yeah, it was crazy, but that was like one of the numerous insane things that happened there. And my love for doing Decatur from that point was like shot. I was like, this sucks. Like, why is this so stressful? My beard was falling out. I wasn't sleeping. I lived in Walthamstow. I was going to Paddington for 7 a.m. every morning. It sucked. And so
were you going to pack it in?
I was just like, I just need to park it.
Yeah.
Because my mental health was terrible. Like, I just was like, the idea of getting up and doing an event and potentially having to deal with something like that, even though like the reality of it was that wouldn't happen.
No.
But when you're in that mental state, you're so fatigued, you don't want to entertain it. And I was just like, every pound I make, I'm giving away 97 pence of it because I'm not making any fucking money. Mm. I was just like, I need to part this. So for a while I went and earned other people's money. And so I worked with our friend Cynthia, Shamma Galangam, who runs Rambutan. So I was consulting for her on a non-profit that she ran called Kitchenette for a while. I worked at the Chilton Firehouse restaurant.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And what else did I do? I worked for Kitchen Provisions, the guys that sell Japanese knives. Mm-hmm. So I did various things. And then I would occasionally get like the odd like catering gig or like do a Decatur thing just for fun. And that's sort of how it persisted. And then I kind of built up a bit more of a head of steam with it, did a few pop-ups, did a really great pop-up at Deanie's in Leighton for a month. And it was like, okay, actually, I think there's something in this. And a restaurant group approached me and were like, we've got this concept we would think you'd be perfect to be like the executive chef for. And I was like, okay, entertaining this idea. And it was this seafood and seafood board bar in Hackney. And I was like, okay, this sounds good.
Great, yeah.
And I was like, wait, if I do this, I'm going to have to sack off Decatur. So I was like, I'll put in like a ridiculous wage and just see what they say and justify it. I put the wage in and they're like, yeah, sure, that sounds great. And I was like, okay, guess this is me then for a bit. And that was in autumn 2019. And then we all know what happened in 2020. Yeah. So then I kind of was like looking at mortgages and houses and being like, oh, this is what I can do with this new wage. Like, I'm going to finally get out of rented accommodation and sort it out. And in the end, the pandemic came. And then it was like, okay, well, this project's not going to happen now. So you've been made redundant and we don't want to pay you any furlough. And so...
Well, we're going to get into COVID properly because this is insane. But I think after all that, we need a bit of a drink.
Yes. You can have a drink.
I like to talk. I'm sorry.
No. I'm just saying, like, that was a stressful... I never thought seasoning would cause so much pain.
I know.
But it clearly has done. And
emotional.
If the guy's listening, I hope you're okay. We won't give you our addresses in case. But when we bring out a drink for you...
Does this go out on prison radio?
It does.
Yeah.
You could give him your address because he might send you some seasoning in the post.
Yeah, true, actually. Yeah. That'd be quite nice.
He won't use the postal service. Yeah. He loves it.
Tom, as we get a drink out, what's your go-to cocktail? We're going to start with your go-to drinks.
My go-to cocktail, if I could choose a cocktail anywhere I've been thinking about this, I think I would choose a frozen Hennessy pina colada drunk out of a plastic cup at City Island in the Bronx at one of the little seafood big seafood restaurants that's over there. That's my like.
That's a dream.
That's never tasted. A cocktail has never tasted better. Do you know?
But if you're in London,
if I'm in London,
oh my god.
Oh,
oh, good. Oh, Wilmington Flood.
An explosion. An explosion. If I was in London,
polish that under the table. Sorry.
It's probably an obvious choice. I quite like a Sazerac. And okay, so anywhere that makes a good Sazerac suits me. It's either cognac or rye whiskey, and then it has a little bit of absinthe in it, and then Peychaud's bitters and a little bit of sugar.
Ugh.
It's like an old fashioned, but with a bit of an
bit of culture.
See one, yeah. Real like classic New Orleans
cocktail.
In it?
No,
they wash the glass with absinthe or herb saint, which is like New Orleans.
That sounds amazing.
I was going to make Sazerac.
Well, what have you made? Because it's going everywhere. But what have you made, Ben?
I've made fundamentally a boozy milkshake.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay.
With, a boozy milkshake with some whiskey in it.
Okay, so whiskey, milk, anything else in there?
I don't know why it's erupting out the glass.
Don't know.
And a teaspoon of baking soda.
Yeah. What about your go-to drink for a night out? You obviously start with a couple of cocktails, but if you're out later in the night?
If I'm out later in the night, there's a couple of... It depends how far gone I am.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I would usually start with wine and beer to keep it classy. But if I'm in a bar, I quite like, this is quite a controversial choice, I quite like a rum and lemonade.
Okay.
Which is my wife's influence. Or, again, like a cognac and ginger beer, something along those lines. The other thing that I've got really into, which is incredibly lame, and I feel a little bit like either a frat boy or a frat girl, is what, like... hard seltzer.
Yeah.
So refreshing.
Like White Claw, is that?
Like White Claw, or like Bacardi.
I can't let a punk rock chef come on this podcast and say like seltzer.
Oh man, so it's delicious.
Should we cheers to this?
Yeah, cheers. I was actually at a punk festival last weekend and all the boys were drinking White Claws out. Yeah.
Really? Oh, that's delicious. How good is that?
Is this a banana milkshake with whiskey?
It's got some other stuff. It's got like malt powder.
Well, take us through it. Come on, this is a food podcast.
I was sort of just putting shit in my blender.
Mm-hmm.
But fundamentally...
Well, that's reassuring.
Vanilla ice cream, banana, some... I don't know if it's Hennessy. I think it might be monkey shoulder.
Okay.
Whiskey.
Nice.
Malt powder and something else.
That's lovely. First time I've had a boozy milkshake. It's really good.
It's really nice.
What about you? If you were having a morning drink, we're going to touch your hangover choice in a second, but your day-to-day morning routine?
First thing I drink in the morning. If I'm... I usually have just like a cup of black filter coffee.
Yeah, nice.
Or a cup of tea. Like nothing that exciting, to be honest. I'm fairly down the line with it. But yeah, nice black filter coffee.
We had a guest on this podcast who had his tea cold. Do you have anything weird about your tea? Do you go black? Do you go white?
I had like a Yorkshire tea. You know, muddy waters, as I say, if you want the description of the colour.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, I'll have like, this is... I have like half a sugar just to take the
edge off.
Myself, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've started having a bit of honey.
Bit of honey?
Yeah.
What, and like a breakfast tea?
I found Lidl. Aldi sell manuka. No, it can't be real manuka.
No.
Fucking Holland & Barrett are selling it for like 60 quid. And then I walked into Aldi and it's like £3.
Yeah, yeah. Nah,
and they're like, never. Legit, 100 mg. I was like, mate, I'll take that.
Hey.
There may just be like, you know, something I believe in. But I have a bit of that in the winter, just to, you know.
Has anybody ever said that they have like the Nepalese like butter... coffee in them, you know, whatever it's called, power coffee.
There was a real trend for that, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah, having an incredible amount of saturated fat.
Yeah, bulletproof coffee, would they call it?
Oh, that's the one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it like with like CBD oil.
Yeah,
your system.
I tried it once. Stick it in a blender. Just tastes like greasy coffee. What's the point of that?
Yeah.
What about hangover cure?
Drink wise. Probably a cold like Lucozade original.
Yeah.
Keep it classic or Barocca.
Okay.
A Barocca's absolutely class for a hangover, man.
Just one or a couple? I like to double up in mine.
Double up?
Yeah, two in a small glass, and then you're just like, wow, that's strong and good.
God damn, what colour is your piss?
I don't know. I'm colourblind, luckily, but it's something shocking, yeah.
Lucozade original, cold and sugary.
Why don't you give us your hangover food remedies alongside that as well?
Oh, man, I mean, most of the time, I think the key thing for me is just like salt.
Yeah.
So having like a salty snack with it is like the key. So like some kind of crisps or something along those lines. That feels like it's sort of...
Would you have a bacon butty? Would you have anything hot or not?
It depends how bad it is, man.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if it's not too bad...
If it's chronic.
Like if it's chronic, man, anything I can get down is crisps or something like that.
Yeah, but
If it's like a... If it's average, like an average one, I think bacon sandwich, yeah, something along those
lines. How do you have it? Soft white bread?
Yeah, I'd go like just standard, like white sliced brown sauce and butter.
Yeah.
And then back bacon, but cooked until it's crisp.
Yeah.
Nice. Not too soft.
So apart from the seafood you do, what kind of meats would you be cooking?
So we do, I mean, this is the thing with Decatur. So we're known for a couple of things, but what I've always tried to do is explore the food ways of Louisiana, and they're so vast. The food of the South comes in so many different forms. It's not just all fine dining or, you know, the white tablecloth dining rooms of New Orleans, and it's not just the gas stations of like Lafayette and the surrounding areas. In terms of meats, I mean, pork's big in Louisiana, which we cook a lot of pork. So we do a lot of boudin and kind of traditional Cajun specialty meats is what it's
called. So boudin's the sausage, right?
It's a sausage with rice. Okay. And it's a sausage that you'll find as you go out on the I-10 towards Texas from New Orleans. You reach an area of southwest Louisiana called Acadiana, and that's the kind of the home of the Cajuns, or like the country folk, who are people that migrated from Canada after they were exiled, French people that migrated from Canada after they're exiled by the British, and they wound up and found themselves in southwest Louisiana, and they kind of lived off the land. And there's all of these shops sell boudin, and boudin is a braised pork and rice sausage, a bit like a black pudding without the blood. And with rice instead of oats. So that's how I'd describe it, like morcilla but without the blood, something along those lines. But a way in which Cajun people would use to extend the meat that they would get from like a boucherie of a pig. So they'd take off all the offcuts and braise that down, and then extend it with some herb spices and rice, stuff it into a casing, and then it's served steamed. So this casing's inedible, and you basically suck this pate sausage meat out of the casing. Yeah. And like the traditional way to, honestly, the most traditional way you can eat boudin is in the front of a truck, eating out of greaseproof paper with like a big gulp. Well, like that's they call that a Cajun meal deal, or Cajun breakfast in the morning, you know. Well, so
I want to quickly just ask you, because it's just jumped in my head, I may forget, when you guys really really kicked off in that second lockdown, you were sending out a lot of oyster shellfish for people to cook their own spread, right? Their own shrimp boil spread, whatever you call it. Was that like, some people can't even use the microwave to heat up a katsu curry. Like, were people panicking about cooking shellfish? I mean, also, people can get ill from shellfish, right?
They can, yeah.
Do you ever panic about that?
I do, and we do a lot of rigorous testing, I should say that. So, like, we have, like, to ensure that we've got, like, a 5-star food safety rating, we have to show the council that we are on top of that kind of thing. So we do, like, temperature checking on all of our packs. So we have, like, these little thermometers you can put in and plug them into the computer, and they tell you what the temperature was during the night and stuff like that. So in terms of temperature, no, there's never an issue. As long as the courier does their end of the deal and gets it there in time, there's never an issue. In terms of complexity, though, there's been a few incidents. For the most part, we've sold, like, at this point, I think we've sold over 11,000 seafood boils since then. I mean, and some of those will be for 4 to 8 people. So that's, I mean, I would say a good 30,000 people have had it.
Yeah.
For the most part, people are like, they're fine with it. Yeah. Because all you have to do is, for the boil, the oysters are a little bit more challenging because you've got to shuck them, but we give you a video and instructions and stuff. But for the boil, all you really got to do is heat up a pot of water and then put things in at the right time. So it's pretty straightforward. And I think that was one of the things with lockdown. Everyone was doing meal kits, right? But if you got a Tom Kerridge meal kit and he sent you like 40 elements and you needed a pan for every single one, and you had to like deglaze things and like reduce sauces and whatnot. And I think that was what made ours quite appealing in that moment. Also, it was, I think, a tap into a tradition that feels like it exists solely in the private residences of a completely different part of the world. And it felt communal. It felt like a celebration. The best complaint I have ever had.
Yeah, go on.
Like, this lady had asked me a couple of questions on Instagram about the kit. And I told her, I was like, yeah, you can get it on Fridays. It comes like this. You can do 6 or 12 oysters. And so Friday comes around and I like look at my phone and it's blowing up. And this lady's coming back to me. She's like, what the fuck is this? And I was like, what? She's like, what the hell is this? This is not what I ordered. And so she sends a picture of this like char grilled oyster kit. And I'm like, oh no, that's the char grilled oyster kit. And she was like, this is what I thought I was getting. And she sends me a picture of like char grilled oysters on a barbecue after they've been opened. And I was like, yeah, it's a meal kit. You got to like open the oysters and then grill them. And she was like, what the hell? And I was thinking, like, what did you want to do? Do you want me to set the box on fire when it comes to you so it's ready?
She
like,
to unwrap
how's it
going to
look like
do
that?
It for us.
Yeah. Anyway, she was like, oh, I'm really sorry. I overreacted. They were very delicious.
A few hours later.
So it worked out in the end. But yeah, there's some interesting... Somebody's complained about a newspaper headline on the newspaper that comes with the seafood boil, which is just like the paper that we get.
It's just
the paper. It's like the news is not very nice, man. Yeah. I don't know what to tell you. I'm really sorry.
It's not my fault.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. But maybe, yeah, we could take that page
out. I can imagine since lockdown, obviously people aren't eating as much in their own homes. They want to get out to physical location. I know you're going up to Newcastle next month to do a residency somewhere.
Yes, we are going up to cook at our friend's place, Riley's Fish Shack.
Best restaurant in the world.
It's incredible.
Have you been there?
You've been?
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
Oh, it's my favourite. It's my favourite as well.
What do you eat there?
Fish.
Yeah.
But then it's super simple, really. Like grilled fish, amazing potatoes, some salads.
Some great salads.
Like, it's hard to explain why it's so good.
The first time you go there, did you read it like a London restaurant menu and go, oh, the halibut.
Yeah.
I get the halibut. And then everything comes with potatoes, salad, like a bunch of extra sides. And you're like, oh, God, I've got food for about 15 people.
And you really are. It's in like a hut or like a container.
Yeah.
On a beach.
It's perfect.
And you sort of just take it and walk onto the beach. But the food is, I don't know.
It's good.
It's really
good. The best fish cooking I think you can find in the UK.
And Adam, the owner, he's got like a real good relationship with North Shields, like fish market.
Yeah.
So he knows all the guys coming in. And I think he sort of started, I don't know what his background is before that. I guess he was a chef, but he started just going down to that fish quay and sort of seeing that, you know, a lot of stuff wasn't getting bought or it was getting shipped out. And he just started buying it. And now they must turn through.
A lot.
Like a lot, because we've sold out of that, and it's like about 400 covers we've got in there already. So
congratulations!
Yeah.
Talking about food, let's get out some food for Tom. Let's go to your go-to delivery order. Let's go to our food go-tos. And Tom, what is your go-to delivery order?
My delivery order. I think there's only a few things that really travel brilliantly in terms of like delivery food. Like a burger to me doesn't like the burger itself
comes
like
a wet sponge.
The chips is just, you know. So for me, we tend to order. You know, if we're going to do like a takeaway, like a Chinese food and just like a straightforward Cantonese takeout. There's a place in Leighton called Yatsing.
Mm.
You know, the classics. We get
what are you ordering?
Crispy duck.
Yes.
Salt and pepper squid.
Yes.
Maybe some crispy chili beef.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing crazy.
Just everything showered in MSG.
Shawarma. I also kind of like a shawarma wrap delivered as well. There's a bit of a dearth of shawarma in Northeast London.
Really?
Southeast London seems to have it all going on. But yeah, I do like, if I could get more shawarma wraps, I'd do that. But
so
yeah,
doesn't
that's
travel my... well, Tom.
What's that?
What
have you made?
Fried chicken.
Oh, look, in a biscuit.
A hot honey butter and pickles.
Oh, my God.
Doesn't travel as well as we'd hope.
No.
Looks good, though.
I'll tell you, it's delicious because I had this for my lunch.
Dish you cook the most midweek, Tom?
My answer to that is stuff over rice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's often like some kind of protein over rice, and that can go in like lots of different ways.
Thank you.
So we do like a ton of like Vietnamese like kind of style roast meats with some pickles and fresh herbs and cucumber and that kind of thing. Or it might be that we do like a kapow, like a Thai stir fry, or we go and we do like an achari chicken, like a chicken curry, like something along those lines. But the rice cooker.
At home.
Yeah.
You're an animal.
Pretty regularly.
Oh.
Is this a gumbo?
For those listening, Ben has just poured out the largest gumbo from the biggest thermos flask I've ever seen. We've got chicken and biscuits. We've got gumbo. It's like being
you're
in town.
Out of a job, Ben. What's going on?
To the ring.
Damn, this is sick.
That is incredible. What's in the gumbo, Ben?
It's very basic. It's got what do you call the base? The roux.
Yeah.
I did the darkest roux I've ever done.
Yeah.
I tried to go as far as I could.
Yeah.
Then the Holy Trinity, celery, bell pepper, and something else. Onion, garlic.
And garlic as well.
And then it's chicken and not the highest grade of smoked sausage you'll ever
Is it try. A Polish kielbasa?
Yeah.
That's the best.
I mean, it's good.
Pretty good.
That is the best.
We're in the...
We're marrying Poland and the southern states of America. This is quite a beautiful thing to happen. What about your go-to three-course dinner party?
You know, I don't tend to cook three-course dinner parties that regularly, but if my friends are coming round, I often will make pizza.
Yeah.
So I'll do like a square pizza in the oven, or I'd have a little, you know, like a little uni pizza oven.
Yeah.
Which actually mostly gets used for putting things like chicken and pork and stuff in to roast those instead of having to start a barbecue when I'm feeling lazy for that kind of midweek rice dinner. But Yeah, if friends are coming around, pizza is always a winner because everyone can have what they want. People can share. People are having a drink.
So that, taking orders?
I just make them. Yeah. They're not getting to order. I just make them and I'm like, oh, there's three vegetarians. There's so, one with meat on there. You know?
Everyone's happy.
What about meal deal combo? You're out on the road.
If I was out on the road, okay. So I would go for Tesco's chicken Caesar wrap.
Yeah.
The mayonnaise in that is incredible.
Yeah.
Some kind of salt and vinegar crisps, maybe a square, you know, the squares.
Yes.
Yeah, I love those. Like they hurt. Like I like crisps that kind of, they're borderline painful in terms of the texture and the amount of salt on them.
Yeah.
And then probably a Purdy's Rejuvenate.
Oof. That's an interesting combination.
Yeah.
That really is an interesting combination.
So it's like calorically like terrible. I don't think you're getting great macros out of it, but you know.
It's a bloody good gumbo.
I want to try this.
Sorry.
Is it though?
Do you not like it?
I found it delicious, but I don't know where it sits in the pantheon of gumbos.
I don't think I've ever had a gumbo before. But
what's it meant to taste like, Tom?
It just tastes good.
Yeah? Because I feel like...
You know what? I feel like there's... Gumbo's one of those things that when you've made it a bunch, you kind of get to know what you like. And when you've eaten it a bunch, you get... Because it's not one thing. I think people seem to think, like, from online recipes, that gumbo is this, like, single dish that tastes exactly the same wherever it's... No, it's never the same. And so people make it in all different ways. So you've got to kind of find what works for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I actually think the style of gumbo that you do... is the type of meat that you're cooking is very pertinent to that. So if you're cooking like game and like big heavy meat, you kind of want a darker roux.
Yeah.
You want something that's going to stand up to that like gaminess. If you're cooking a seafood gumbo, I wouldn't even use a roux.
Really?
Yeah, I would use filet powder, which is like ground sassafras root, and okra to thicken it potentially.
Okra, yeah.
But like there's some fundamental things that's always the same, which is that it's a thickened stew. And it often will have a variety of different proteins in. But yeah.
I
think it's delicious, yeah.
Yeah.
From a chefy perspective, cooking, I didn't know what levers I could pull. So like a lot of the food I cook, you know, I've got like a few things up my like acid sleeve. I've got like a salty sleeve that I can put. Do you know what
You've got
mean?
Various sleeves.
I've got eight sleeves.
Yeah. Well, you might use soy or fish sauce or something like that. Yeah.
And you can play those things out. I didn't know at what levers I could pull with this. And so it's like, it's different. It's different cooking.
But it's really tasty.
I think it's interesting as well, like the roux in there, like you got to figure out like how you want it to taste. So that roux, you could take that roux darker.
Could I?
Yeah, yeah. You can take that roux
Don't
darker.
Be afraid then. Don't be afraid.
Well, I'll tell you why I didn't take it any darker, because it produces a fuckload of smoke.
Oh, it does. Yeah.
So the roux.
You're smoking out your baby.
Technical, yeah. You get oil super hot, put flour in and cook it until it goes as dark as like chocolate or where I was heading. And the room was just filling with smoke. So I thought, fuck, we better stop now. Let's put the vegetables in.
It smells good though. It smells like, I always think it kind of smells like popcorn.
It's a lovely smell.
And also, do you know the most disconcerting thing is we make, so when we do a gumbo, often we're making a huge batch of it. Yeah. So we have a 50 litre pot full of gumbo. So we'll make the broth, we'll braise the meats down, but then we add the roux in afterwards. So we whisk it in there. So you're just making a giant vat of roux.
Yeah.
And that, it honestly, it like gets into your skin. So I'll be like in the gym, I'm like, fucking smells tasty. It's me. That is so weird.
Tasty. I don't want you to eat that.
Why not?
Why? I'm doing it.
It's too salty.
Really? Is it?
Yeah.
Why is it too salty? What's too salty about it?
Everything.
What, the biscuit or the chicken?
I think it's the chicken. I put fuckloads of spice on the chicken.
I'm getting a specific spice on this.
What are you getting?
Go on, tell us.
I can taste something.
Go on. I like the Polish sausage in that gumbo, by the way.
Have you got, like, cumin in there?
Mm-hmm.
Is that wrong?
No, but it's just an unusual... addition. Yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with that.
We're going to go into your locations, Tom. You've been absolutely wonderful. But we are going to kind of swift through your locations. So let's start with a go-to weeknight restaurant.
It's called Kofteci Metin. It's on Green Lanes. It's like a new restaurant on Green Lanes. So Green Lanes is a Turkish area in Haringey. All the Turkish restaurants are, for the most part, down that road. A lot of the Turkish restaurants are mangals. And these mangal restaurants that have like an 80-item menu where they have all the different grills and they have moussaka and they have like fish and they have like a ton of different things. Kofteci Metin's complete opposite. He has like seven things on the menu. The main thing is these kofte, which are beef kofte.
Yeah.
And they're the softest, most meaty, delicious. They're about the size of your little finger, little kebabs. And he does them with fresh pide. And you have some grilled tomato and pepper with them. And they are incredible. And then everything else that's there including a 7-foot-long reproduction of Guernica, which is on the wall, is incredible too. But the salads, especially, the salads are really good. He has like a white bean salad. He does an incredible smoked aubergine salad. But there's like 5 salads, and it's great. And it's inexpensive, and he's so nice. And the whole thing is just, it's a real treat. And I would go there, if I was nearer, I'd go there very, very regularly. But I've been... probably three times in the last 3 months, so I had to put that one in.
Yeah, nice.
Favorite place for a date?
Braun.
Yeah,
on Columbia Road.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are other places, but that is the place that I've been to. Probably the kind of fancy restaurant that in London that I've been to the most. I just think the cooking's always really solid. I've had one dish that I didn't like there in about 15 visits, and everything else has been really brilliant.
That's a good try.
They've great wine, service is great. The room on like a sunny day is wonderful. Yeah.
What about your go-to pub?
The Birkbeck Tavern in Leighton.
Okay.
It's very near to my house, which probably makes it my most go-to, but it's a real throwback pub, carpeted pub with darts, and they've got a really nice beer garden in the summer. It's like what you'd imagine the perfect local would be, although I do think they should clean their lines more often. That's my only complaint. Yeah.
Best place to get a pizza in town?
I went on a pizza crawl earlier this year. As I did 3, and I would find it hard to choose between them. We went to Crisp. Everybody loves Crisp, right?
Yeah.
Although it's such it's arduous trying to get a table there.
Tracks from the
joint. Yeah, it's just like I don't want to have to like think about having a pizza like 6 weeks in advance to get one.
Yeah.
Vincenzo's in Bushy is great. Just like such a vibe. Like that place, I love that you can walk into that place and it feels so transportative. And then Gracie's, which is in like St. Albans, like just around the corner.
They follow us on Instagram. She used to work at Campbell Arms, didn't she?
Think so,
Grace,
I'm not sure. Maybe. I don't know them all that well. I've had a few.
Well, shout out to Grace's.
Why are they
so good?
I like pizza that's got a bit of attitude. I think that's the same with Crisp as well, and the same with Vincenzo's. Is that they're all pretty well fired pies. They're not. I'm not into like having lived in New York. My favorite type of pie, like coal oven style pies, so Totono's or you know any of those kind of New Haven spots, and that to me is. My favorite pizza, it's got a bit of crisp, it's got a bit of like char, it's got a bit of attitude about it. And it's not just like a big, sloppy, wet mess like Neapolitan pizza is. Although I like that, but like if I was going to choose, that's my
shout out to Grace's.
Yeah, Grace's.
And finally, your dream long weekend.
My dream long weekend would be flying out to San Sebastian. I would spend an afternoon for sure at one of the cider breweries over there, Cidrerias. There's one called Petrategui, and they do an incredible like 5-course lunch for like €28, and you get like aged dairy cow and like a salt cod omelette, and then delicious chorizo, and then the dessert is just a bowl of walnuts, some manchego, and some membrillo. And it's just like man, this is like, and then unlimited cider from barrels that are straight. They're like 12 feet tall. Which is really fun. That's great. Obviously, the old town and doing like all the pincho kind of hopping is awesome. Going out and eating fresh fish in Getaria, where El Cano, the famous like turbot restaurant, is. That place, there's that place, and there's a few other little restaurants that do a similar thing for a slightly less white tablecloth way. They're all great. And then I love this place called Gerald's Bar over there, which is this just really beautiful kind of corner bar. It's in, I think it's called Gross. It's the other side of the river from San Sebastian. And they, I think it's owned by an Irish or an English guy, but they do just incredible like bar food and really great cocktails. And it's such a lovely vibe in there. But that coupled with being able to be out on that like fresh kind of Atlantic breeze blowing in your face and going for swims and like, you know, there's little hikes and whatnot you can do. You can go out and see the church that they filmed a bunch of Game of Thrones in and walk out to that, which is right on a spit in the middle of the ocean. All that kind of thing is like, I mean, if I could spend a weekend doing that, I'd be very, very happy. Yeah, for sure.
Tom, you've been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your love, passion, and obviously incredible work you're doing in everything in this food world and also in the punk rock world back in the day. But just to finish off, you can save 3 of the dishes, some of yours, some of what you've eaten, some of the pizza places, wherever. If you can save 3 items, what are they going to be?
Oh my gosh, that's pretty hard. So I would definitely save some of my mum's food. That would be that'd be the first.
I thought you were going to say your award-winning oysters 2016 time.
yeah, we've done that enough.
Oh, okay.
I'd do that. I would do a piece of roasted halibut at Riley's in the north, and then I think I would just for balance, I'd have that smoked aubergine and Tulum cheese salad from Kofta Chimetin in Green Lanes for a bit of health.
Well, if you want the best seafood in the world, we're going to put the link for all of Tom's incredible food in the link for this bio. Until then, Tom, thank you so much for coming in. Pleasure. Guys, we'll see you all next week. Please rate us 5-star, leave us a comment, share, subscribe, pass it on, share the love, and we'll see you all then. Tom, thank you very much. Those are your go-tos.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.